Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and you're listening to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Before I introduce today's guest, I do want to thank our sponsor, QBAC. QBAC is a next-generation advancement solution that reimagines alumni engagement to drive giving. QBAC's proactive, personalized approach to engagement helps you build your major gift pipeline even in a time of social distancing. QBAC's AI-driven system uncovers actionable insights about alumni interest and connections and automatically delivers them to advancement professionals for use in cultivation. QBAC is a force multiplier for development officers, enabling them to focus on what they do best, developing deep relationships with individuals and converting them into active donors. Learn how to raise more money with less by going to www.qbac.com to schedule a free demo. I would also like to tell you about Responsive Fundraising's training. If you are looking to align your team around a shared understanding of effective fundraising, let's talk about our four frameworks. If your culture doesn't feel right, before you begin any significant planning, launch a capital campaign, hire another member of your team, let's ensure everyone is on the same page. How about inviting us to be on site with your board, leadership team, volunteers, and staff for your next planning event? If you'd prefer a virtual seminar, we can do that too. Let's get your team thinking more critically and carefully about the road ahead. Shoot me an email. I'll also put some information in the show notes. Hi, Bert. I am delighted to have you on the Fundraising Talent Podcast today. You and I met, I think it was probably 18 months ago or so. I think we started a conversation about what's happening at your mission before COVID, and we haven't talked since, and I think we have some mutual friends. So I'm delighted to sort of get an update on what's going on in your take on the mission world and parachurch world. But before we do that, how about we just let you introduce yourself, Bert?
Sure. Well, first of all, Jason, thanks for having me. I'm delighted to be here. Bert Rosen, I'm the president and CEO here at Knox Area Rescue Ministries, also known as CARM. I came here after 17 years with Prison Fellowship Ministries, which was the organization that Chuck Colson had founded. Never thought I would be living in Knoxville, Tennessee, having born and raised in Miami, Florida, but here I am. Wouldn't want to be anywhere else than where I am today. And I've been privileged to be the CEO here, and they let me keep on going as long as my legs will carry me. And so here I am, 18 years later, loving what I'm doing, married, four children, two boys, two girls, one of whom actually disappeared years ago, ended up homeless on the streets, and that has everything to do with how I ended up getting into the work I'm actually doing. And here at CARM, we are right on the outskirts of downtown Knoxville. And to give our listeners some of our scope here, we're home to about 375, 400 plus men, women, and children on a nightly basis. We serve about 1,000 meals a day, six sittings a day, two at breakfast, two at lunch, two at dinner. And we have an array of other programs that are intended to provide an initial response and meet the needs of anybody coming through our doors, all the way up to long-term recovery program for men and women. We are 100% private. We receive no government funds, no state funds, no United Way funds for everything we do. And we operate on a little bit of a $7 million plus budget annually.
Yeah, Bert, I don't know that when you and I first talked, if I got your... I don't know if it hit my radar that you had also spent as long as you did with Prison Fellowship. When I first got
Sometimes I regret, and sometimes I just sort of say, God lets it, you know, God has his way with us, right? The good way to put it. We might have our plans and God has his, and usually his ways win over ours. But I did some ministry work. I really had a heart. I thought I had a heart, and perhaps I still do, and we'll see where that goes in the future. But I did a lot of ministry work with Bill Glass. Are you familiar with Bill Glass?
I am.
Yeah, and you know, we went into the prisons. I take it a privilege to go into some of the facilities that we went into. Do you have a read on what those organizations, how they have navigated, say, the last 12 months? You know, I've never had a guest on here that has any history or involvement with Prison Fellowship. What does that world look like in sort of a COVID reality? And do you know?
Well, best I know. Let's talk about it from a delivery of ministry programs, if you
sure, will, yes, sir,
versus how they might be doing health vitality in their funding.
Yeah,
programmatically, when COVID hit, a number of the prisons, but particularly federal prisons, began to cut off, just like we did here at CARM. We shut down our entire volunteer program, and many of the prisons began ceasing to allow volunteers to come into the prisons. Well, at Prison Fellowship, just like other prison ministries, including Bill Glass, they rely on volunteers who go into the program,
yes,
into the prisons,
exactly,
to deliver their programs. Shut that down, well, you no longer have volunteers who are going in on a regular basis. But Prison Fellowship, I can speak to in particular, that necessity became the mother of invention, as it did for so many during COVID. And they began looking at ways to bring their programs in virtually. And because they enjoy such a healthy respect and admiration from the prison system as a whole across the board, they found a warm reception to offering alternative ways to bring their programs in. And so as best I know, I don't follow them very closely, but enough on the periphery to know that they people miss volunteers coming in because there's nothing that replaces human contact.
Yeah.
You just can't top that. But that being said, their whole message is about proclamation of the good news of the gospel, and they have found ways to go ahead and do that. And I know because I give to them and I'm on their mailing list that they have managed to do well during these times because what they've seen and what we've seen here as well, Jason, is that the Christian community has continued to give not only at regular levels, but actually at a higher level during what has been the last year of COVID.
Yeah, I'm certain that you can appreciate this because I'm sure that Prison Fellowship used similar resources. But if there's anything that I was probably 22, 23, so I was out of college, newly married, working in a parachurch organization, sort of getting my wits about me when it came to fundraising, but I was doing that work with Bill Glass. Mm-hmm. Champions for Life was, they had gone through a renaming at the time. And what that organization does for an individual like myself, a young person who's trying to, you know, consistently tell their faith, they put the four spiritual laws in your hand and they put you in front of these people that might scare you to death. And you present the gospel to them. And I gotta say, if there's anybody, you know, any experience, there was about a 5-year window there, probably 2000 to 2005, 2006, where I was doing that work with the Bill Glass organization. They really got me confident to, you know, sharing my faith. And most interestingly, it was with people that were behind bars in some of the most notorious, most infamous sort of places in our country.
Yeah, no, I get that for sure.
Yes, I know. I would imagine that you certainly can grasp what that opportunity looks like. So, Bert, I have not had a guest on the podcast as of late who comes from the parachurch space, and in particular comes from the rescue missions or what is now the CityGate Network. And I'm just very interested, for the sake of my own information, for our team, and for the sake of my listeners, to just sort of hear how an organization that oftentimes, you know, we have a local rescue mission here in York, Pennsylvania, where I live. And, you know, they're serving oftentimes they're amongst those organizations that are sort of serving the least of the least, if you will.
Sure.
And that's the population that oftentimes is easily overlooked, oftentimes marginalized, easily not making it on the 5 o'clock news. And for you all to be as close to those individuals in the midst of a pandemic has got to be something that, say, a guy like me who sort of lives out in the suburbs and relatively privileged doesn't understand. And then you got to mix all that in with the fact that you got to pay the bills every month. So yeah. just sort of pull, if you don't mind, and just sort of pull back the curtain perhaps on what the last 12 months have looked like for you. We're creeping up on a year now in the midst of this pandemic. What's the last year look like for you?
So let me go back and say that calendar year 2020 has been the best fundraising year in our history.
That's great to hear.
And we have heard that from other rescue missions. Yes. As well.
Yes.
And that comes at a time where, if you read the headlines here in Knoxville, the Knoxville News Sentinel, the headlines were talking about how nonprofits in general were down about $20 million in income. And we have been fortunate that that has not been our story.
Yeah.
But let me take you back just a little bit earlier in the year. And it really started in early March when our governor had declared that he was considering, and the big word there was considering. He was considering a shelter at home order across the state.
Yeah.
And so we quickly thought, what does a shelter at home order look like when you're home to 450 plus men, women, and children every single night? And so first thing we did, we typically here at CARM, on a Sunday morning, some folks are going out into the community, some are going off to church. But by and large, Sunday is the day where people are generally heading back out for a little bit. And so I did something rather unusual. I waited for people to leave on Sunday morning, and then I ordered our doors locked. Nobody coming back in. Mm-hmm. And we quickly scrambled as a team to take a look at how we were going to reconfigure every single part of our building. About 80,000 square feet here, in two different buildings. One building has two floors. The other building has three floors. So let's look at reconfiguring. And the word social distancing, we're just beginning to bubble up
there. Right, sure.
But we knew what we were going to have to do. And so we only left the doors locked temporarily. But the first thing that we had to do was change up our lunch service. So we quickly went to to-go boxes, set up some tables and chairs outside so that we can begin to make sure that we were providing a meal for everybody at lunchtime. Breakfast a little easier. You have people who have spent the night. They're coming downstairs. They can have their meal. And when they're coming in for dinner, then they're generally in for the evening. But we were also trying to reduce the in and out inside the building because we knew we were going to begin to take people's temperatures and so on and so forth. But the reality is we were doing a ready, fire, aim because it seemed like back then new information was coming forward almost daily. And I'll come back to that in a minute. But we also had to make another decision. We do an event each year. We call it the President's Gathering. We started it the year that I got here, and I arrived in May of 2003. We did our first event March of 2004 on only about 3 or 4 months planning. It was at the Grove Park Inn in Asheville, North Carolina. When we did it that first year, we didn't have a plan for year two because who knew that it would turn out to be what it has actually been for us. And
right.
Certainly that's something we can circle back to later. So now here we are 17 years later. The event occurs very late in the fiscal year. So ours was scheduled for April.
Right.
COVID hits in March.
Right.
And we're thinking now we've got a little bit of a dilemma.
Yeah.
We're going to do this in North Carolina. They had not yet declared a state of emergency, but we're asking ourselves, what do we do that's really in the best interest of our donors?
Yeah.
We have built relationships with them. We made a decision years ago, Jason, to move from transactional giving to relational giving and to challenge people who were supporting us to do it because they trusted us and they believed in our cause.
Yeah.
Versus the what I'll call the chicken dinner where you come, you hear a speaker, you write a check. Nothing wrong with that, but I wanted to begin to make that shift.
Yeah.
So now we're looking at trying to make a decision. Do we go with the event? Do we call it off? And if we call it off, we're talking about, you know, high six, seven figure income that comes in gifts and pledges with basically 60 days left in the fiscal year. And we don't like finishing in the red.
Right. Nobody does. So,
yeah, no, go or no. Well, what we decided was that we were going to operate in the best interest of our employees to keep them healthy, the best interest of our donors to keep them healthy, and that we would just have to trust that somehow the hotel would let us out of our contract, the speakers would allow us to defer or, you know, roll them over to a following year.
Sure.
And so we made the decision, call it off.
Yeah.
When we made that decision, we had no refund promise from the hotel. It would later come because later they declared a state of emergency as well. They shut things down and that got us our money back. But now we got to make up almost $1 million worth of income with only 60 days left in the fiscal year.
Yeah.
So we began calling all of our donors, telling them what they were doing. And because of the strength of the relationship, what we found is folks understood. And we were going to have to make up that net in order to finish the fiscal year in the black, which we not only did, we trumped it by a mile, much to our pleasure. So that was the first part of it. But then now we're past that. We're planning for the next year. We had another fundraising event scheduled. And the reality was then that fundraising is never going to look the same again. I don't think anybody expected this to last as long as it has.
I certainly didn't. I expected 90 days. I expected to be at ball games, but, you know, we go to the local ballpark.
Uh-huh.
I expected to maybe, you know, by mid-season, we'd be back at the ballpark in July. It was the most, it was the most depressing summer of my life.
No, I get it. And I used to live in Pittsburgh and I used to travel, you know, Route 30 all the way across the state. Right. And so I know your neck of the woods. In fact, we had an office there in York way back when. But having said that, we scrambled and we knew what we needed to make up by June 30th. Well, then we began looking at other events that we do.
Yeah.
And we were having to reschedule all of those or just take them off the calendar altogether.
Yeah.
But in all of that, we found two things were occurring. And then I can step off of that and go back to some of the operational stuff. But here is where we found that the strength of the relationships that we had built were going to be a blessing to us in ways we never would have imagined.
Yeah.
So gone are our fundraising events. Now, in our particular case, direct response, and I know some of your thoughts about, you know, down that path. But that being said, that became a very strong piece for us.
Yeah.
Up about 35% over what it had been in previous years.
Uh-huh.
People were just responding. No one was going out. So the mail became a very good medium for us. Our normal messaging points, email blasts, and other things, and people were responding well. Our major donors, if you will, understood the challenges that we were up against, and so they responded exceptionally well also. One other piece in all of this, you know, about 80% of our total income, Jason, is donation income. 20% comes from income-producing businesses, and the largest part of that is we operate 18 thrift stores in the area. And those 18 stores generate 20% of our total income.
Okay.
So we had to close the stores because they shut everything down here.
Right.
So with that, we closed the doors on our thrift stores. And that's about a loss plus or minus of $35,000 a day in income. Every day we're shut.
Yeah.
So we're watching all of this happen. But because our donors were so, so grateful that we were continuing to do what we did, serving the folks that are coming through the doors, that they continued to support us in very, very strong and positive ways. And so while everybody, you know, certainly had access to PPP funds and all the other stuff that was out there, we were able to avail ourselves of that. We qualified for it, paid it all back, and then we didn't have to pay anything back, I'm sorry, but all of the things that you had to do to dot the I's and cross the T's, we did. And so there wasn't any money that we had to refund back in all of that. But our incredible financial year was not something that was dependent on that. We were seeing a responsiveness anyway. We just didn't know what was going to be happening at the time. So now,
what were you? So you're. What were you thinking in September? So there's sort of the part of what I'm starting to sort of piece together is that there were sort of three phases that I think people went through as it relates to fundraising, but also in terms of direct services. And I haven't gotten a read on, so they got, you get on the other side of that big question. So one of the things I'm reading up on, or sort of the message I'm getting from a lot of nonprofits, parachurch and otherwise, is you had to make that big decision. A lot of people went the direction you did. You made a decision that said, we're going to chance the fact that our donors will sort of step it up, even though we don't have that event. And a lot of people are found within that first sort of phase that everything was okay. They took that risk. But then we get on the other side of the summer, and there's sort of the uncertainty of the holiday season sort of lingering. I'm not getting a read on what the sort of the fall looked like when oftentimes organizations start to think about planning, you know, the budget year for the following year. You don't know if that event's going to work again, you know, a year later. I kind of wonder if there's that middle, and then I sort of characterize it as sort of the phase that we're in now, which I feel like we've sort of settled into the unpredictability of the moment. But the world seemed really unpredictable, I think, in say September and October. Would you say that's true?
It certainly did.
Yeah.
And, so as we're looking at all of that, you know, typically, and you know the fundraising cycles and how it works in the summer, where organizations like ours typically see a drop in income during the summer months,
yeah,
only to watch it begin to rise October, November. It hits a crescendo in December.
Yes, exactly.
And December 31st is our single biggest day of the entire year.
Yes.
Well, what was catching us by surprise was that the typical summer slowdown didn't occur in terms of giving.
It didn't slow down. It just kept going. So you didn't get a summer slump, what a lot of us call a summer slump.
No, we didn't.
Okay.
And so the only thing we could attribute it to was the fact that people were staying home. They were putting off their vacations and doing all those other things that typically they're away from home.
Yeah.
And so, you know, in direct response, it's the tickets and, you know, the month after month kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Well, we were getting people who were sending in their 3-month gift at one time, but they kept on giving. And so we were kind of taken back by what's going on here. People are just continuing to give. And then it kind of carried itself right in. October kept going, November kept going, December kept going. And we were taking a look at what we had historically budgeted for income during that time, giving ourselves reasonable stretch goals, believing for just a little bit more along the way. And it just kept blowing us out of the water.
So you experienced a good summer. You made the very bold decision before the summer. You got through the summer very successfully, but you didn't know. I mean, you didn't know if that sort of that uncertainty, that very fortunate sort of serendipitous sort of those experiences where God sort of shows up, where he has to show up, right? Because 3 months worth of positive activity in a nonprofit organization of any sort isn't long enough to know that this is a trend line.
No, it isn't.
Right.
I cannot control what people give.
Yeah, right.
We can be faithful to do the task and do those things that you know to do. But what I can control is spending.
Yeah.
And so taking a look at that, we began building contingency plans. And we're on a July-June fiscal.
Yeah.
So now we're basically 3 months into a fiscal year. Well, because of the way we budgeted, our board agreed to allow me to do an annual budget, but to break it up into 2 6-month budgets. And what we did was I froze the hires and everything else and said, we're going to see where this lands come January 1.
Yeah.
And the board would agree that if we're sitting at a certain position, they will allow me to let the spending reins out a little bit.
Yeah.
So that we would still finish on budget, but it was not budgeting as usual. So it was a very conservative budget. And I trimmed about $650,000 out of the budget, set it aside on paper, so that if something happened and we had to cancel our Dragon Boat event, or we had to cancel our Hope event, or even now with an event on the books for the Greenbrier in West Virginia coming up in April, we don't know if those things are going to go or not.
Yeah.
So by creating my little internal nest egg on things that I could control, at least we'd be in a better position to finish in the black. So there were contingencies for more spending.
Yeah.
If things were good, but there were also the contingencies for scaling back programmatically and staff-wise if things did not pan out the way we were hoping that they would. And by God's grace, they not only turned out as well as we were hoping for, they exceeded our expectations.
Okay. So, Bert, if you're paying, I suspect, and I think you've been paying attention to stuff that I put on social media for quite some time. Very grateful for that. One of the things that I'm developing, and I think if I'm hearing you correctly, I think you're almost a fascinating case study to along the lines of exactly what I'm talking about. I think fundraising has suffered for too long of sort of seeing the donor and the consumer as one and the same. And if you look at consumer confidence, which oftentimes happens, it happened at September 11th, it happened in the recession, and it happened during COVID-19. Consumer confidence tanked in April and May, or I want to say maybe it was March and April, you know, right after the first quarter. And then when they tested it, you know, when they're looking at consumer confidence sort of at the after that really good summer run you had. But what I'm hearing you describe is that your donors are not behaving like consumers at all. That there's something going on, which is the point I think I want my listeners to hear. Cause I think that fundraising has much to learn. And it sounds like you've got a fascinating case study to sort of prove it. Your donors are not behaving like consumers because, like, for example, I told my kids, kind of like you're making those 6-month plans. I told my kids back in September, October, in much the same way that you're telling that organization, we're living about 6 months at a time right now. We don't know what the world's going to look like. So we're going to work in smaller increments of time. But also, we were not spending like consumers the same way. It's not to say that we weren't spending, but we were spending differently. Sounds like you were seeing that at a macro level as well. Am I right?
Yes and no, because we have such extremes in those who financially support us. You have those individuals who said, I'm giving because I know I'm supposed to.
Yeah.
And so here's my $1.87 to buy a meal for one person.
Sure.
And then you have other people who are going to the other end of the spectrum, who were in a position to write a check for $25,000 or more, and they were not changing how they were looking at it. But in fact, in some ways they were, because there's a seed sowing principle at play. And so we have folks who decided to stretch and give more than they normally would. So while others were conserving, they're watching what's happening in the world, they're watching the stock market do whatever it's doing, so on and so forth. And so while we had some folks who have said, we need to tighten our own belt just a little bit right now, we had others who were saying, I'm doing just the opposite. I want to give and continue to sow into the ministry that you all are doing. Now, Knoxville is not a large community.
Yeah, sure.
And but we enjoy, if you want to call it, brand recognition.
Yeah.
So when your donors trust you, when they hear from you, and it's not the hyperbole, it's not a manipulative message, It's exactly what they want to hear about how their dollars are being invested in the ministry and the fruit that it's yielding. They're asking a question. They want to know about our health and our well-being.
Right.
They want to know how we're doing at serving the folks that line the streets of Broadway, which is right outside our door. And so we stepped up communication, but it wasn't communication with an ask. It's, Jason, I just want to let you know what's going on. Here's how we are responding. Here's what we're doing programmatically. And so there's those who give transactionally and those who are investing in your ministry. And it's the investors, if you will, who stepped up to make sure that we were well taken care of.
Is it fair to say that in 2020, two-way communication, which means the donor was calling, I had a guy recently tell me, he said, the donors are calling me back. So I'm leaving a voicemail. They're actually calling me back. They're calling me back in ways that I've never experienced in my 20-year career, whatever. Would you say that 2020 was one of those years where the people in your development office were perhaps experiencing two-way communication with their donors in ways that they had not experienced before?
The way you asked the question, that they had not experienced before. So
yeah.
We have a very robust process here for calling all of our donors.
Okay, so you have you have the benefit of a two-way real communication.
What I would say, it was more.
Yes. Okay.
So typically, if I were calling you, you know, you might get a message like, hey, Jason, this is Bert Rosen over at CARM. I'm sorry that I missed you, but you gave us a very generous gift. Here's my number if you want to call me back, but you don't have to.
Yeah.
I just want you to know how grateful we are for your support. Well, generally, one in 10 calls gets a return phone call.
Right, right.
Now I was seeing, you know, two and three return phone calls. And they're saying, hey, I appreciated the thing, but how you doing? How you holding up, and how are things down at the mission? And so I love that kind of dialogue. But folks were picking up the phone. And our development team, they're on the phones all the time making thank you calls. And so I would say it stepped up, but it wasn't that atypical for what we see.
See, I think one of the silver linings in 2020 is we're going to have people who are working in a shop like yours who have engaged with donors in more two-way communication, be it for whatever reason that happened, and they're going to know how to communicate with their constituencies. And I think it's going to inform our practices going forward, because you have, I think back from the, you know, from my consulting time, but all certainly the time when I was in these offices, there are so many of us in the fundraising space that have not had real meaningful engagement with donors. And I think in the last year, I had one of the guys at Bloomerang, one of the technology firms big in our space. And he was telling me last summer, he said, people are picking up the phones. And when they're picking up the phones, you're having real communication with donors. And we're also utilizing platforms like this with greater regularity. And so the cost of having these conversations, you know, we're not necessarily hopping on airplanes, driving across town, finding the necessity of buying lunch, all those sorts of things. What do you think? Are we going to understand our donors better on the other side of this thing because we've talked to them more?
I think some people will.
Okay.
So I don't know that that's true in our case, and because we are so in touch with them in so many different ways. We have so many different touch points between what we do here, and so many of our donors shop our thrift stores. And so there are just so many different touch points going on. But I think I want to think about my answer here. So one of the things that's happening is people are becoming a little bit more personal and personable.
Okay.
There's more of a willingness to engage where, you know, if I'm now making that call, it's a thank you call, which is the right thing for me to do, to call you to say thank you for your gift. But if I say, Jason, so how you doing in all of this? You may have said, I'm fine, thanks. Hey, got to go on. I'm busy, so on and so forth. But now you're taking a little bit of time to say, hey, thanks for asking. You know what? My wife tested positive and it's been hard for us. So we're getting to know them better in that regard, because they're becoming more transparent as people have tried to figure out how to navigate their own world during COVID, if that makes sense.
It makes – so my wife and I – so, Bert, my wife and I are sitting in the living room yesterday, and we're talking about the people that are and I had no idea I was going to bring this up, but it aligns with exactly what you're talking about. So – there's a lot of people in our local community that because we're not going to the ballpark, because we're not able to attend church, there's a lot of people that literally for a year now we have not interacted with. And I think sometimes we forget, and perhaps this is what the realization, sort of the aha moment that you and I are sort of bringing to the surface together, is that fundraising at its best sometimes in moments like this creates meaningful engagement in ways that other parts of the world sort of can't. I mean, when going to the ballpark, when going to church on Sunday, when a lot of the things that we sort of take for granted that put us in front of people have to be put on pause, charitable giving, which when a person has that charitable, you know, that impulse to give generously, and then when we do it right on the receiving end, we pick up the phone and say thank you, and they call back and they say, you know, they share something. They're more vulnerable and honest and transparent about their own experiences. I think what you're saying is that fundraising, perhaps in many ways in the last year, has had opportunities to show up in ways that it hasn't been able to show up in perhaps a long time.
I think you said that exceptionally well, and I would agree with you.
Yeah. In terms of being generous, in terms of being outwardly generous, which is to say that I think fundraising, perhaps maybe the stories we're going to hear, because I think I'm getting, and I'm not getting a lot of this because I haven't been at, you're probably one of my first guests that I'm sort of trying to pull it out of. But I think we're going to hear that fundraising professionals were more outwardly generous, more engaged with our constituents, and consequently, we're going to perhaps get, you know, pats on the back for showing up in ways that we had not in the past, because we know we're great communicators. We know how to have conversations. We know how to do this. We just put it in overdrive and did it.
Yeah. I think that's well said. And, you know, I've had more Zoom calls than I can shake a stick at, and I'm sure you have as well. Yeah. And that because here in Knox County, things have not lifted yet. Yeah. There's limits on restaurants and all the other stuff that goes with it. And so breakfast meetings and lunch meetings have become a thing of the past.
Exactly.
Where you and I could spend 45 minutes over breakfast. So now we're trying to schedule a Zoom call just because the face-to-face contact matters so much. But, you know, relationships is what greases the skid.
Yeah.
And so we took a cue. I'd love to say we've really nailed it, but we haven't. But a guy by the name of John Cotter out of Harvard wrote a book a number of years ago called Our Iceberg is Melting.
Okay.
It's the story of a colony of penguins who think they're going to live forever on this iceberg because it'll never melt. And if you've never read the book, I won't ruin it for you. Well, it changed my world.
Yeah.
My wife bought it for me as a gift. It sat on my nightstand. And once I picked it up, it was one of those easy reads, like One Minute Manager and some of those things. But Cotter, the book is really about 8 essential ingredients for organizational change. But he drills down and suggests that a melting iceberg is anything that represents a threat to the livelihood of the enterprise or represents a significantly missed opportunity. Each of the penguins has a name that matches their personality or their character. One of the characters in the book was a guy named No-No. And so whatever you ask, No, do we have a problem here? No, everything's going to be just fine. Well, the other character in the book, Fred, is the one that said, I think we could have a problem here. And so I went to our team and I said, I read this book. And let me just ask you, do you think? And almost all of them became no-nos in the book.
Right.
Well, that led to us studying the book as a team and what ultimately launched what we would later call the iceberg dialogues. Well, we began to look at what threatens the livelihood of the enterprise. Well, here where we, Katrina, when it hit, that was a wake up call.
Yeah.
And so we thought, so if we hit another natural disaster like that, people who would write and say, Dear Bert, I'm sure you understand that this month I can't give to CARM. Now, they actually took the time to write, but I can't give to CARM this month because those folks who've lost everything from Katrina, they need my help more than you do right now.
Yeah.
And so it's like, wait, hey, remember us? We're the ones on the corner in Broadway and Magnolia 24/7, 365. We're still here serving the needy in this community. Just bad form.
Yeah.
But the wake-up call was anything that threatens the livelihood of the enterprise. And so if we looked at it that way, we began looking at what are those things. Well, a natural disaster is one. But the other is if we don't begin to change how we relate to our donors, how we interact with them, how we treat them as investors in the ministry, and not kill them with mail, not always asking for the solicitation. Yeah. But if I don't begin to respond differently to Jason, we're going to lose Jason.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's two pieces. If all I care about, Jason, is your pocketbook, I don't have a relationship with you. That's just a means to get to getting into your checkbook. Yeah. But if I begin to genuinely care about you as a person, your family, your life, your well-being, your livelihood, I get to know you in a different way. And so with all of that, we began saying we've got to begin to change. And it was pivotal for us in terms of how we looked at direct response fundraising, sure, how we looked at our appeals, how we began to interact with our donors, and how do we help this donor community build relationships not only with us, but with each other. And so I'm a perfectionist, so I always think we can do it just a hair better for continuous improvement. But that has proved to be exceptionally strong for us. People know us, they trust us, they appreciate us, and they do appreciate the fact that that we're not receiving any government funds to, right, to keep us right going. And so that shift, and then what are the missed opportunities? Not just in those we serve, which led to program innovation, but it also led to how we look at the donor world as well. You know, the reality is I got to write a check every month to pay the utility bill and everything else. And if we are determined that we are not going to be taking government money and we're not going to be a United Way agency, I'm not faulting United Way at all. Please don't. I wouldn't want anybody to hear me say that. We just choose not to take money there. Then we've got to figure out how to do this different so that we can generate the resources that are necessary to do not only what we're going to do today, but what we know we're going to need to do 5 years from now. And so I don't know if that it makes sense to me when I'm talking
about
it.
I don't describe myself as a perfectionist, but I do believe in sort of self-organize. I'm trying one of the book project that I'm constantly referencing on with my guest that I'm working on really tries to dive into the notion of complexity theory and introduce the idea that human behavior in any open living system is self-organizing. And I think if we look at what has transpired over the last year, we can see, we take all the tools that we utilize to engage and interact with our donors, we might be able to see some self-organizing function, some ways in which human behavior has learned how to self-organize itself. And perhaps if we can sort of see those cues, we can begin to better define what it is we're doing really well. Because what I'm hearing is that the year went really well. It sounds like an opportunity for a growth spurt. And then it taught us some things. But what I'm hearing more than anything else, and I think I've heard this with a couple of previous conversations, it just sounds to me like fundraising showed up this year in ways that it may not have showed up in the past for our donors. And I'm guessing some of the pause in your responses is because you have historically seen your organization doing that, showing up, but you've had to wait, Bert. So yes, outwardly towards those donors, you've been doing the showing up. It only really works when the donor shows back up in response. That's what the donor did this last year for you. That's the feedback loop closes. So if you think about a feedback loop, sure, you were doing that. You were figuring out how to outwardly make yourself accessible, be more responsive to your donors. But in the midst of a very uncertain time, and when the opportunities are limited to engage with people that you care about, because I can't sit next to those people at the ballpark or those people in the church pews that I care about, I'm sure as hell going to pick up the phone and talk to the people at the rescue mission. You follow what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I think this has been an encouraging conversation. Bert, I'm sure there's somebody listening to our conversation. They know how to find me. They hear plenty of what I've got to say, but perhaps they want to reach out to you and start a conversation. How would you suggest that they do that?
They can call my office, 865-673-6561. They can go to our website, KARM, that's Knox Area Rescue Ministries, KARM.org. Or they can email me, and they'll find that address on the website as well.
Bert, it has certainly been a pleasure. I am glad we still have not met in person. I haven't been able to buy you lunch or buy you a cup of coffee, but thanks for giving me 45 minutes of your time.
Well, thanks so much, Jason. And if and when we do have that opportunity, I got this running deal with anybody that I have a meal with. One pays, the other prays. So you can decide which you would like.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must-read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all-too-familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.